The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis and welcome to Music Weekly from The Guardian. In today's podcast, we'll be trying our luck as film reviewers.
I now realise there was a certain amount of dissembling going on here. It was quietly put away. It wasn't lost in the sense of it vanished off the face of the earth. I think Leonard always knew where it was, but he wasn't going to admit it because he'd found the whole thing somewhat embarrassing.
That was esteemed filmmaker Tony Palmer there talking about how his Leonard Cohen documentary, Bird on a Wire, has finally been released, amazingly 38 years after it was made. As Bird on a Wire prepares for its television debut, Tony tells us about working with Leonard Cohen, and we'll also be giving our thoughts on the film and on music documentaries in general. Singles Club this week also features Crystal Castles, Gatekeeper and Licky Lee. Plus, we'll have your feedback. All in Music Weekly. Hello, Rosie Swash.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
Excellent. I'm not bad, actually. I have my in-laws staying with me.
Oh, cool.
Which is great, obviously.
Very relaxing.
Yeah, hugely relaxing. Also here in the studio is my mother-in-law. No, is the editor of guardian.co.uk/music, Mr. Tim Jones.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Very good.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. So today, sort of a film special.
Yes.
On Music Weekly. We'll be looking at Tony Palmer's film Bird on a Wire. Palmer, if you don't know him, is a multi-BAFTA-winning film and documentary maker with over 100 films to his name. He has worked with the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix and Frank Zappa, to name but a few. In 1972, he was asked to film Leonard Cohen on a 20-day European tour and was granted, and I think this is key to the film's success, full access. On completion of Bird on a Wire, however, Cohen and his manager is actually called Marty McHatt, which is like the greatest name for a rock manager in history, Marty McHatt. Cohen and Marty McHatt, anyway, were very unhappy and recut the film to their own specifications. Their new version was a massive flop. It didn't get a general release or TV broadcast anywhere apart from Germany. Much to Palmer's dismay, the original film never saw the light of day and was presumed lost until a series of events conspired for the film to be recut in its original form, which we're going to find out about in a minute. Bird on a Wire, the original director's cut, if you like, was shown at festivals all around the world this summer to considerable acclaim. Also released as a DVD in September. Luckily for us, BBC Four will also be screening it on November the 19th. BBC Four does music programming so very well at the moment, doesn't it? Absolutely remarkable. Rosie met up with Tony Palmer to find out how the project was reborn. But first, let's hear a clip from the film. This is Cohen backstage after a gig in Germany.
Oh, you don't sing anymore?
Pardon?
No, somewhere.
Well, we go to Geneva.
No, I mean now.
No, no. Why are you
saying? Oh, tonight.
Would you like to listen?
Yes. Yeah.
I don't have any plans. Why?
You don't have any place?
No, I don't have any place. Do you have somewhere for me?
Yes. A lot.
It's hard to come on to a girl in front of the camera.
What?
I just felt like going out for a drink or something.
Yeah.
With you. But not with other people. It's not, the other people are beautiful, you know. Just, I mean, they're all beautiful, but I just can't make it with everybody, you know. So maybe we can have lunch or a drink or breakfast or something, you know.
Leonard looked at the film and I think he neither liked it nor disliked it. He was concerned that it was confrontational. That was his word. Don't ask me what it means. I have absolutely no idea. But I think he thought, you know, it was in your face a bit.
It starts with, I don't know if it did it then, but it starts in Tel Aviv with...
Right.
Yeah. But it's a fairly gentle riot, is it?
It didn't feel like it at the time, let me show you.
OK, leave those people alone. They can stay there. I know you're trying to do your job. But you don't have to do it with your fists.
I mean, I think he has said in various interviews that he was concerned that he looked very raw and wasted, which indeed he was. Mm. And very naively, and why the hell I said it, I now can't remember, and I've spent 38 years regretting it, I said, and it was because I liked him and because I admired him as an artist enormously, that I said, Leonard, here's the material. See what you can do. Make it less confrontational, if you see what I mean. So 2 years and of his own money, over $300,000 later, they came up with version two, which opened and closed on the same night at the Rainbow Theatre in North London. I was not invited. I was not allowed to see it, in fact. I never saw version two until about 6 or 7 months ago. So it opened and closed on the same night, and then it was shown, I think, on an extremely obscure German television channel, and that was it. And it literally disappeared. And nobody knew why. I saw Leonard, not frequently, but I did see him. And always he said to me, "Where is the film?" And I said, "Don't ask me. You tell me where the film is." You see what I mean?
It's like when Plato said... it wasn't Plato. You know, it was his... It wasn't Plato. It was that cat that copied him. Socrates. I mean, Socrates didn't bother to write it down. But Plato saw he had a good gig writing it down. I'll write down everything he said. I'll publish it after he did.
I now realize there was a certain amount of dissembling going on here. It was quietly put away. It wasn't lost in the sense of it vanished off the face of the earth. I think Leonard always knew where it was, but he wasn't going to admit it because he'd found the whole thing somewhat embarrassing. So now we leap forward half a lifetime. I mean, it is half a lifetime. And I mean, if we're supposed to sort of hang on for 70 years, we're talking 35, 36 years later. Then a miracle happened. I mean, the first miracle happened, which was we were busy trying to restore parts of the original 200 motels. And Frank Zappa's manager, Frank Zappa, of course, being long dead, Frank Zappa's manager was in his warehouse, or a warehouse where he stored stuff, looking for the offcuts. And from the warehouse, he rang me and said, "I've just seen 40 or 50 boxes labelled Bird on the Wire." He said, "I don't think it's the Goldie Hawn film because they're in terrible condition, you see." I said, he was called Herb Cohen. I said, "Herb, get back in there, bribe whoever you need to bribe, but for God's sake, get the stuff out of there and ship it to London," which is what he did. So, high excitement. These two gigantic pallets arrived one day here.
And this is last year?
January.
This is 2010?
This is this year.
Oh my goodness.
January. And immense excitement, of course. Unloaded them, plonked them in the store. And I opened one box. And in total, there were something like 296 completely rusted up cans. I mean, to get into them, you had to hammer them open, literally with a hammer and a chisel. I opened one, and I realised that these were just the offcuts. You know, the rushes, as we would say. So it wasn't quite slitting my wrists, but I realised, you know, I thought this was another complete dead end because there was no way I could reconstruct the film because I never found the negative. To this day, nobody has ever found the negative. It may exist, but I really doubt. So I just, forget it, you know. One Saturday... I mean, it can't have been more than a week or so later. It was pouring with rain, and I thought, right, what can I do that's useful this morning? So I must organise these boxes because they're in the way of absolutely everything else. So I began to kind of shunt them around. And I accidentally knocked over, second miracle, I accidentally knocked over one of the boxes. I mean, literally by accident. And out tumbled the dubbing tracks, the sound mixing tracks of version one. And I knew it was version one because the charts were inside and I had my handwriting notes against them. So I knew this was the real thing. So I got hold of my digital sound mixer from whatever bed he was in, I can't remember, and said, "You will come immediately. We are immediately going to the studio and immediately we are going to listen." And we did. And this was it. This was the soundtrack. It needed a fair amount of work on it, but essentially, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, it was all there. So what to do now? I have a soundtrack, but I have no picture. So Muggins goes back to 296 cans, and I'm now hammering open each can. And we put them on the viewing machine, and we carefully wound them through. They were in terrible condition. And, that little bit, I know where that goes. That goes there. So we'd cut that little bit out, send it to the laboratory to be polished and cleaned and digitally stored. And the picture that you now see is made up of just under 3,000 fragments that we found in that way. Yeah, I mean,
how long?
Well, 6 months. 6 months. I mean, 6 months non-stop work. And I reckon the version that is now on the DVD is approximately 95% of what it was when I first did it. The other 5% was simply I simply couldn't find particular shots, so I substituted other shots. And quite often they were inside a song. Now, Leonard, if he did the same song on two successive nights, would do it in a different key, different speed, sometimes different words. So I was finding, you know, the odd line that I couldn't find the picture of. So I would take that line, picture, from another version. So I'm now having to speed them up, slow them down, re-pitch it to make sure that it, you know, passed in one take, which is what we did.
Laws do not compel me to kneel grotesque and bare. I myself am the pedestal for this ugly hump at which you stare.
I mean, I think one of the many ironies is that this process of restoration has probably cost more than the original film. Not version two, Leonard wasting his own money, but Marty Machat. If there's anything that I have ever made that I'm proud of, it is the fact that we managed to put it back together again. I mean, it's... And, you know, when I see the reaction at the Green Man Festival, where it had its UK premiere, or in Canada, where it had its Canadian premiere.
It was sold out.
I mean, it's always sold out every time. And you know, I watch the reaction of the audience. And, I mean, the very first screening was at the biannual get-together of the official Leonard Cohen website fan club fanatic.
I've watched that footage, actually. Yeah,
I mean, well, you've seen 10, 12-minute standing ovation at the end. I mean, I couldn't speak. I was asked to speak at the end. I mean, I had introduced it. And I'm kind of standing there on the, you know, because suddenly you thought, well, you know, it's not a bad film, but the fact that we managed to find it and put it back together again was, you know, I feel it's, personally, it's something which has a real sense of achievement just because I managed to do that.
Creativity.
No, I couldn't tell you anything.
You couldn't. But you know something about it.
Well, if I do, it's like speaking about one's own religion. It's not. It doesn't serve you to speak about those things.
What do you like to talk about?
I prefer not to speak at all.
What an incredible story, Rosie. What an absolutely sort of inspirational and remarkable thing. Did he at any point say if he'd had any sort of reaction from Leonard Cohen?
Yeah, I asked him how much contact they'd had and what Leonard Cohen's reaction had been to the news that he was remaking it. And it's all through various parties now, I think. Leonard Cohen's sort of wearing a wry smile about the whole thing and teased him over the years, but never would actually give him the footage.
Interesting, absolutely fascinating idea.
And especially also, because he said the two versions, in terms of how Leonard Cohen comes across, which was his biggest concern apparently with the original, is there isn't that much difference.
Mm-hmm.
So,
really?
Yeah.
So the sort of recut version isn't much, it's just a worse film. It's not a different, particularly different film.
Exactly.
Intriguing. I think what's brilliant about it, having seen it, is that it, you know, it's very clear, we mentioned this in the introduction, that it works because he's given complete access to this major star, you know, going around the world, which is something that just doesn't really happen anymore. It's a bit of a peculiar name to drop in relation to Leonard Cohen, but I was talking to Gary Barlow from Take That last week, and he mentioned that documentary For the Record, which came out in Take That For the Record, it came out in 2005, and sort of preempted their reunion. And it's an amazing documentary. It's a real no-holds-barred thing. I Take That talk very honestly about, you know, what it was like being in Take That and sort of intra-band wanking competitions and things like that. And Gary Barlow goes, yeah, you know, the thing about that was, you know, we would, you know, people didn't care about us at the time, you know, and nobody even thought to ask us if we wanted editorial control. And I thought, yeah, and that's why it's a good documentary, because you didn't get any editorial control over it. You know, it seems sad to me that bands now require that as a sort of preemptive gesture. They won't get involved in this. And yet everyone goes, you know, no one ever goes, I tell you what a great documentary is, that one about Tupac that his mum did. You know what I mean? The official Tupac. People always go, yeah, Don't Look Back, Bob Dylan, you know. Tim, have you seen the film? Do you like it?
I do like it.
You're a Leonard Cohen fan? Are you a kind
Not
of,
massively. No. I mean, he was part of my university years, and he was always... actually, I've been reading a lot of Adrian Mole recently, and it always makes me laugh that he knows when he can't speak to his wife because he goes home and she's listening to Leonard Cohen. I was a bit like that with my roommate, to be honest.
Really?
I knew when he was having a very bad day. Cause
hear. He's one of those artists that sort of it's a slightly peculiar kind of critical trajectory, whereas in the 80s it seems to be, you know, Dirigo to kind of laugh at Leonard Cohen, and you get all these jokes on the Young Ones about Leonard Cohen and stuff like that, while taking, I don't know, Amazulu seriously. It's really peculiar. But you enjoyed the documentary despite not being a huge fan.
I was speaking to Rosie about it earlier, and we were kind of talking about how it does show just how weird and odd being on tour is. Because there are moments of kind of really intense kind of, you know, he's talking about his art and what it means. And then there's bits where he does an interview with a foreign journalist who then says, do you want to hear it back? And he's like, not really. But he says, oh, well, I'm going to play it back anyway. And then there's some kind of interview footage about a war. And he's like, it didn't record.
We've all been there.
Oh, God. And it's just the farce of, you know, and there's the German fans who demand... they want their money back for the show, but when he offers to pay it out of his own
wallet,
they don't want that. They want an apology to everyone, and they want him to go outside and pay everyone back.
And then one of the other German fans goes up to him and goes, do me a favour, never go to another gig in Germany. I never want to see you at another gig.
It is absolutely amazing. You certainly get that sense of, hey, nobody does interviews like that anymore. There's all these people that used to go, you get this in Bob Dylan documentaries, like Don't Look Back and things like that. People really, you know, used to go backstage and ask, like, pop stars about the meaning of life.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, you wouldn't do that with Kasabian. You know what I mean?
Maybe on tour in Europe, you do still get that. I mean, I don't know. But it's interesting what you said about access, is because I thought, not only do people want copyright approval now, but as a journalist, I mean, the amount of times I went on tour with a band, but on tour meant following their tour bus in the photographer's car.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking, you know, you really got the sense with this that wasn't the case. He got every little bit that he wanted, really. So.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing it does, I guess, as well as showing these kind of early 70s interview technique that journalists seem to have, is it sort of this, it does the thing of kind of capturing 70s global tensions. There's a lot of stuff in there about Vietnam, you know, the band seem to be continually arguing with authorities and things.
There's
like
suddenly
that.
Footage of Vietnam, isn't there, that kind of comes up, very, very unpleasant footage that seems to come up out of nowhere.
That's really shocking.
Yeah, it is incredibly
shocking.
In the
context of what you've seen before, it's just... what the hell is going on?
You don't get that very much in documentaries. But I mean, again,
that wasn't in Take That.
That, off the record, is intercut with kind of mutilated bodies. It'd be amazing if it was. But I mean, again, that's something that you used to get a lot more when people placed, I suppose, a great deal more socio-political import on rock music than they used to. So you get films like 1+1, the Jean-Luc Godard film, which is the Rolling Stones. As we know, recording Sympathy of the Devil, intercut with kind of footage of Les Evonimons is that how you pronounce it? In sort of Paris 1968 and Revolution and all this kind of malarkey. Nobody, I guess, views rock music in that way anymore as a kind of thing that has anything to really say.
Any political perspective.
Yeah, it's interesting. You wouldn't get that in a documentary about Radiohead because people would think it was pretentious, I suppose. Yeah, that's a brilliant jumping off point of a discussion.
I think there's a lot of it is his vision, isn't it? Because have you seen All You Need Is Love?
Yeah, I've seen bits of it, yes.
And I kind of think, I mean, I like that, but I found every one of them was completely different. And it was just like he was just kind of making up as he went along. And I suppose that's part of the charm where, you know, sometimes he'd focus on someone's story, like the Ragtime one. And then other times it would just be a bit all over the place. And I think with this, it was almost like you didn't quite... part of its charm was that you didn't really know where they were going.
So it was more just showing rather than actually telling you a story. It's more just saying these things happen.
Yeah, this is the access I got. This is what happens. Mm. This is, you know, my personal view rather than I'm going to tell you a story from A to B.
But I think that's a really interesting thing to do. I mean, talking about other great documentaries, I keep mentioning Don't Look Back. Mm. But that seems to me one of the great things about that and about a more recent sort of great, probably the recent great music rock doc, which is Dig, Andy Timmermans' film about the Dandy Warhols and the Brian Jonestown Massacre, is that actually the editorial eye in it is quite... It just lets you make your own mind up. Because I know those people that watch Don't Look Back and go, my God, Dylan is 60, 65, man. So cool. And I think the guy's a bit of a dick, to be honest. He's a horrible... What do you want to do in Time magazine, man? Shut up. you know, obviously brilliant music and wonderful and, you know, but, you know, and other people see a really cool guy there. I see this miserable...
I think it's when you've met lots of pop stars, you probably...
And also there's that point, there's that thing in Don't Look Back, there's that bit in it where he's having a go at the journalist from Time magazine and his suggestions of what... You should show a picture of Nelson Rockefeller next to a starving child, man, because that's reality. It's like, oh, fuck off. Is that really your big idea?
But maybe that's what you were saying about, you know... We don't expect bands to be political. We don't necessarily want them to because we don't take them as seriously.
No, absolutely.
If they start banging on like that, you just think, oh, you idiot.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you don't expect people to have, you know, I suppose it's an era where you don't really expect politicians to have all the answers. You sure as hell don't expect, you know what I mean, the guitarist from some chill wave band to know what to do about the economic crisis. You know, other favourite rock documentaries, people. I'm throwing Dig out there. I'm throwing...
I really like Some Kind of Monster, but I'm not, you know, by any means a Metallica
fan. No, I'm not either.
You couldn't be. And certainly watching that, no more of a Metallica fan. But I think when we were talking about access and the great, you know, the downfall of any music documentary since has been the lack of access that a filmmaker might have. Some Kind of Monster is Metallica trying to make a record, trying to get back on, you know, sort of trying to get their creativity back when essentially they are probably a little bit too old, way too successful, and they get the counsellor in who is just amazing.
Absolutely
amazing, especially when they try and sack him and he gives them all the reasons why they shouldn't. And they just come across, you know, when Lars Ulrich is trying to sever himself from his ridiculous art collection.
Oh, yeah, he's trying to sell all these Andy Warhol
and he's
pages,
getting really kind of emotional about these horrible pieces of ludicrously expensive art, and you just think, my God. And the fact that they looked at that and thought, we're going to come across okay.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because again, I think if you were a Metallica fan, you'd go into that, because I'm not a fan of that kind of music at all. And I must admit, I knew so little about Metallica that at the end, it comes up at the end of that film, you know, they went on to make this album and it sold like 15 million.
I know.
I was like, for 15 million, go that crap. I don't believe anybody, you know. And obviously, Metallica, one of the biggest selling bands in the world, and they're wonderful, and it's my fault I don't like them, and not Metallica's name. But I sort of think you could go into that. If you're into Metallica, you'd watch that and think, wow, the raw honesty, this is a really, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if you didn't like Metallica, you'd go into it and go, oh, a bunch of dicks. Tim?
The two I'd mentioned probably that we haven't gone through is one is the Anvil film.
Yeah, what a great
film. Just kind of the opposite of Some Kind of Monster.
I just think that's so good at, you know, you always hear about the successful bands, don't you? Yeah. And it's just such a great feeling of what it means to really devote yourself. But it was on telly the other day, actually, the Made in Sheffield documentary. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't seen that, actually, no.
I watched that when it first came out, and I just thought it was a really brilliant way of talking about how kind of the geography of where you grow up is so important to the sound that you actually get. So I thought it was well worth checking out.
I'll throw another recent curve, but it's really interesting that all the documentaries we're talking about that are recent are kind of... They're either about unsuccessful bands or, you know, with the Dig documentary, it's bands where she got in on the ground, you know what I mean, on the ground floor with the Dandy Warhols, and they wanted to become successful subsequently. Amazing film, well worth checking out if you haven't seen it. It's been on BBC Four, I think. It's a film called Heavy Load, which is a film about a punk band from Brighton who are comprised of three guys with learning disabilities. The drummer has Down syndrome and blah, blah, and two of their carers. And they form this punk band together. And they're amazing. I mean,
Is it a new document? You know,
yeah,
they
came out
formed recently.
A couple of years ago. They've been playing around Brighton for a long time. And they are absolutely incredible because it's just like the most troglodytic kind of intense badly played punk rock. It sounds amazing. I've seen them live a couple of times, and I can't recommend them highly enough. If Heavy Load come to town,
did you
go
interview
and see
them?
I interviewed them for Guardian Weekend. Yeah. But the film itself is absolutely amazing, and what I guess it does is it doesn't treat people with learning disabilities any different to normal people. And you learn a lot about being in a band and what it's like doing sort of small-scale gigs and these tensions that arise. The drummer is continually threatening to leave the band for one reason or another. And it's sort of funny and it's sad and it's incredibly moving. And the story about the friendship between these five people is brilliant. And I cannot recommend it highly enough. Check out the documentary Heavy Load and go and see Heavy Load if they play near you. It's an experience, once experienced, never forgotten, let me tell you. Okay, so Bird in a Wire will be shown on BBC 4 at 10 p.m. on November the 19th. Check it out if you haven't seen it already. Let's have a bit of feedback from last week's show. I knew this was going to happen. On my choice for Singles Club, James312 wrote, "Loving the podcast. Good. Loving you too, James. But the Gang's cover of Sade's By Your Side is truly awful. Alexis, you have fab taste." Thank you. "But in this instance, I think that Rosie and anyone in the vicinity needs to stage an intervention. The autotune is a cliche, and the cover adds nothing to the original structure or sonically. The point of Sade, I always thought, was her voice. You can't better it, and Sweetback, her backing band, are beyond fantastic. And when did Lovers Rock," he adds, "become something to be ashamed of?" Did we say Lovers Rock was something
didn't.
To be ashamed
no,
of?
No. I think he might be talking more generally about the
world. Oh, okay. I certainly wouldn't. He said, "Put on George Faith's To Be a Lover and Dance Around the Apartment Now." I would add, put on Silly Games by Janet Kay and listen to that as well. Sexy, smoky, hip-grinding music. It's great. We also had lots of comments about Michael Gira and Swans. We went to see Swans last week, didn't
Not
we?
Not together. You went to Brighton, I went to...
We had very different experiences.
Well, I enjoyed the first hour. It's a good thing to
always
say
a bad sound.
But unfortunately, I did that very stupid thing of drinking quite a lot before the gig started, so getting quite into it. And then thinking, I better not drink anymore, otherwise I'm going to be too hungover when I have to get up at 7 o'clock. Swan's gig, not made for people that have to get up at 7 o'clock the next morning. And so I began to sober up and then have a sort of hangover during the process.
Did you start getting drunk again after that?
Oh, God, it was just you can just feel it in your summer. It's not the volume as much as the frequency that they're aiming for.
You see, this is the baffling thing that happened to me. I went to see them in Brighton and they just weren't that loud.
Really?
They weren't that loud. And the most peculiar thing that happened to me all of last week is I went to see Swans on Wednesday with my best mate Joe, my old mate from school. Both huge Swans fans. Went to see them. And it was great and all, and had a great time. My mate Dom was there as well. Fantastic. But it just wasn't that loud. Went to see Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark on Friday. Ear splitting. It was so fucking loud. It was
maybe they swapped amps.
Maybe they swapped PA systems or something like that. I was totally. I was just bamboozled at this OMD gig. They were handing out earplugs outside the OMD gig.
Did you have, when Swans played in Brighton, the 10-minute kind of, I don't know what instrument was making the noise off stage, but just caught, and it literally was 10 minutes long. And then Thor came on.
And then Thor. What a great name. They've got a Tubular Bells player called Thor.
And played 10 minutes of the Tubular Bells. And this is before Michael Gira had even stepped
on stage.
I'm
so pleased they did not go to this gig.
It was amazing. It was fantastic.
Trolled at that point.
They did some of the old hits as well. They did I Crawl. And what else
Beautiful
did they
do? Child.
Beautiful Child. Sex God Sex. Yeah. It was very good. Anyway. SD1000, posted, "Gira sounds like a real patronising douche. Gira sounds like a real patronising douche, man. What a shame. I really like Swans, their early work anyway. But someone who presumes to judge whether his fans are listening or not is too far up his own humourless arsehole for my taste."
I like up your own arsehole rather than arse.
Arsehole, yeah, he's up his arsehole. I also think accusing Michael Gira of being humourless. SD1000, you know, Michael Gira's world of laughter. And Fiendish Loom wrote, "Saw their late 80s incarnation live and couldn't hear anything else for about the next 3 days." I assume he's talking about Swans rather than Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark. "Kept losing my balance and having to lie down." It was great. "Swans assaulted my entire metabolism in a now where I've never wanted repeated. But making other people suffer for your art is an interesting aim. I'm amazed at Gira's powers of endurance. It makes me feel old even thinking about it. Thank you, Fiendish Loom. Thanks for all your feedback. Keep it coming at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Singles Club now. The place where we each bring in a track to discuss. And first up, it's Tim's choice. Wow. I feel like doing robotics around the studio. That was Chains by Gatekeeper. Tim, tell us about Chains. Tell us about Gatekeeper. Tell us why he brought it in, please.
I know quite little about Gatekeeper, apart from it is two guys. And
two guys, no way.
You'd never guess.
You'd never guess, would you?
it's made by a crowd of women.
This is coming out on MeRock, which is...
The guy from, what's its name's label?
Big Pink,
yeah.
Milo from the Big Pink's label.
And, I mean, I just think it's a really kind of evil, spooky track. And a lot of dance music for ages and ages has been kind of stuck on that 80s thing. And this I don't know, it kind of marries the kind of that kind of new wave of goth and, you know, all the kind of dark, doomy hipster music that's coming out, but actually makes it something you want to dance to. And also, it just reminded me of being in a kind of techno dungeon.
Spent a lot of time in techno dungeons.
In my youth.
Sexy techno
dungeons. Sexy techno dungeons. okay, well, interesting. Goth revival. It's happening. I mean, it's definitely mm-hmm. happening, isn't it? I mean, it's one of those things. Happening. I mean, on one level, obviously, you know, goth never died. So undead. Rosie, are you inclined to start henering your hair and stinking of patchouli oil?
always.
Yeah, of course. I mean, not that you don't already.
Exactly. I don't dislike the goth revival. I just don't like this particularly. I hate in the same week that Stephen Fry has quit the universe for making sweeping generalisations about women to make sweeping generalisations about men. But this is a man's song.
You think so?
It was interesting. Pretty
Hey, which brings us back to Swans. Were there any other women at the Swans
yes,
gig?
There were loads of women, and it wasn't just. I went with Ben Beaumont Thomas's girlfriend, Jen,
wow,
who was a massive Gira fan. In fact, at one point when he was singing, oh, she's going to kill me. When he was singing, I am sexist. She went, you're well not. it was like take that gig for her.
Wow.
But no, it wasn't. It wasn't lots of girlfriends either. It was just lots of women.
Anyway, you think it's blokey music?
I think it's bloke music. It comes with these guys called Thunderhorse, I'm assuming guys.
Thunderhorse,
who make animations to go with it, and they look like computer games. I mean, it's just a little bit...
geeky.
Super geeky.
But geeky
it's
goths.
Not just that it's geeky, it's blokey, which is slightly different from just being geeky.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I thought it was okay. I think I see the goth sort of element in it. I think there's quite a lot of music like this about at the moment. It's a bit Italo.
Yeah.
It's got that sort of angle to it. I liked it, thought it was okay. Chains by Gatekeeper is out on December the 13th. This is Rosie's Choice. And we were lovers. That was Not In Love by Crystal Castles, and as I'm sure you recognise, that's Robert Smith of The Cure on vocals. More goths on the dance floor. Rosie.
This is, I'm not a huge fan of Crystal Castles. I don't hate them by any means. It's just not a massive fan. But this song obviously features Robert Smith of The Cure, and they're covering a band who were contemporaries in time of The Cure called mm-hmm. Platinum Blonde, who are a new wave band. Mm-hmm. And when I went back and listened to the original, I thought, well, this just sounds to my ears like very much like a Cure melody, not mm-hmm. to suggest that they, you know, they're trying to sound like the Cure, just that it was very of that time. So I find it quite interesting that Crystal Castles are taking something which was of the Cure's time. They've got Robert Smith involved. They haven't, you kind of don't really hear them in it that much.
No.
You know, it's not, and in a way, I kind of feel like they've decided to curate this track with him in mind, and that's quite nice. It's a nice track. It's not life changing.
But they have covered this song before
without Robert Smith.
Yeah,
interesting.
That was a very different version.
Oh, was it?
Yeah,
okay.
That was because what struck me about this was because their version was just quite weedy actually.
Mm-hmm. Was it?
Yeah, But this has got like a big...
It's got a beefy Robert Smith vocal.
Well, yeah,
no, the chorus is big.
It's almost slightly Gatecrusher, isn't it? Yeah. It's like really like heading for the dance floor. I thought it was quite interesting, because obviously they're playing on that 80s nostalgia, but I thought it was quite interesting. It had a very 90s kind of trancy nostalgia going on as well.
I think The Cure are due for a bit of a critical sort of reassessment quite soon, particularly as a goth revival.
Have they not had it?
They kind of did have, but it didn't.
I don't think they've ever gone away in that sense. There's so many young bands.
They definitely went away a bit. I think they were quite a bit of a laughing stock in the 90s.
Yeah,
do you remember
the Mary Whitehouse experience?
You what, sorry?
Was it Mary Whitehouse experience where they used to do the piss take of Robert Smith?
Yeah, that's true, yes. I don't know, I always sort of saw, maybe it's my own experience of music, but I always saw The Cure as being a bit like Charlie Perfume, you know, or like a Perfume by Lonthric. And it's like every boy's first indie band in the same way that every girl's first Perfume is like, you know, Tweed by Lonthric or something.
Oh, I see.
And then you got onto real indie music after you know. And actually, that's a really, really unfair assessment of The Cure. And I've ended up going back to quite a lot of their albums. They all got reissued recently, well, fairly over the last few years. And with the exception of the first one, Three Imaginables, which is terrible, they're really good. They're really, really, really... There's just a run of albums that are amazing. And they're not the most original band in the world. And they spend... It's quite intriguing because they spend a lot of their time ripping other people off, you know, New Order and Joy Division being the two obvious cases in point. But they're kind of brilliant songwriters. They're really amazing. There's something really intriguing about The Cure. So I'm pleased to hear Robert Smith's voice again. Not in Love by Crystal Castles, featuring Robert Smith, is out on December the 6th. And finally, this is my choice. This is my time, like a shot. Go ahead, go where you go, where I can do no harm. Go ahead, go where you go, in my honey loving arms. That was Licky Lee's Get Some. I brought that in. I really like Licky Lee, and I think in the sort of pantheon of female, vaguely electronic-y, you know, singer-songwriter type. She seems to have got overlooked in the stampede that, I guess, the front of the stampede, there's Lady Gaga, and at the back of the stampede, there's Robin. And, you know what I mean? Somehow, Licky Lee's work seems to have got overlooked. I actually think she's really inventive and interesting. I really liked her last album. I like this. I like the sort of like Bo Diddley-ish kind of feel. It's got, it seems original and different. There's also a great clip of Licky Lee doing one of her tunes with Bon Iver, where they're all sat around a fountain and Bon Iver just sort of playing and Licky Lee's singing. And I just thought it was a good record. and that's what it's all about, isn't it, kids? Any other thoughts on Licky Lee?
I thought that her sort of debut song a little bit is quite possibly one of the sexiest pop songs ever written. But then after that, I found her a little pretentious and not quite matching, you know, the stature that she seemed to want to project. And this, as well as another song called Paris Blue, which was, you know, released or leaked at the same time, whatever you want to call it, the two of them made me think of Feist's The Reminder.
Interesting.
Because there's a kind of full-bloodedness to it that works really well with the kind of voice she has, which I guess is quite dulcet tone and a bit more kind of oomph behind it, which this track has definitely got. So yeah, I liked it.
Tim?
I liked it as well. At first, I mean, I liked her early stuff as well, but when I first heard this, I found it a bit like it just passed me by a bit. And then suddenly she's talking about being a prostitute.
Yeah, that's quite a striking lyric.
Yeah, and so you're going to get some, and then you go back and read all the lyrics and they're actually, you know, they're not the kind of fey, kind of whimsy pop that we've been talking about, like the people she's associated with. And then I started like investigating the track as well, and the rhythms, it's quite like Bow Wow Wow.
It has got such a Bow Wow.
And there's actually quite a lot of inventive kind of pick and mix stuff going on throughout the track. It's good. It reminded me a bit of Murder Weapon, you know, the Tricky song that we did in
the
podcast, just the kind of relating sex and violence, and I thought it was good.
Fantastic. Sex and Violence, very good. Get Some by Licky Lee is a free download from a website. It's available now. Check out Licky Lee, which is lykkely.com/ if you want a copy. That's your lot this week. Just the one interview to accommodate the extended Bird on a Wire chat. Great to see you as ever, Tim.
Brilliant to see you.
Yeah, you could have said that a little bit quicker. There's moderately more enthusiasm.
Sorry, I was reading something.
Yeah, yeah, so you said. Cheers, Rosie.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's more like it. You see, that's the response. The kind of response that I want. My thanks, as ever, to producer Pete. Thanks. I'm Alexis Petridis, and thanks for listening.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.